Hi, I'm Molly Wonsall.
And I'm Geoffrey Wonsall.
And for the last 16 years or thereabouts, we've been having lunch every Saturday, and often our conversation turns to murder.
Which is what prompted us to start this true crime podcast called Blood Ties.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wonsall and I'm here with my father, Geoffrey Wonsall.
Hello everyone, thank you again for listening. Thank you for keeping with us. It's been a funny week. I've read a lot of books this week, a lot of thrillers, because I'm in the midst of picking out summer reads.
Got any readers. Top tips for us?
There are some very good ones out there. There's a new Alex Marwood called The Poison Garden, which I like quite a lot. There's a very clever book called The Chain by Adrian McKinty. There's an excellent spy thriller called American Spy. There are some really good thrillers out there at the moment, and it's quite difficult. I'm doing some thriller reviews, but I'm also doing a selection of all the first 6 months of the year for books you might want to take.
Holiday reads.
Books you might want to take with you on.
When I went to Tunisia, literally every English person near me was reading like a Michael Crichton or a Stephen King or one of the big ones.
Michael Courtier.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the numbers are astonishing for...
Men and women.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the whole crime thriller genre, and that's crime straight, crime thriller and a thriller, swamp every other genre.
Yeah,
they are gigantic business. And even though people are reading rather less, they are nevertheless reading this genre rather more.
Do you know one called Slow Horses? Is that a thriller? Might not be.
I don't know.
No, I don't know why. It's a detective story.
But I do it, obviously, partly of my living, and I've been doing it for 10 years, slightly longer. And it is still a great treat, and I do read for pleasure. But sometimes you just really get some absolutely cracking.
Have you been watching anything on TV, or have you not had any time?
I haven't really had very much time, I'm afraid.
Gone are the days of consuming series upon series.
Yes, I have been. I did have a look.
The winter time you watch more TV.
Hibernation. I did watch again. That Welsh.
Hinterland.
Hinterland. I'm sorry, Hinterland.
Hibernation is a great name.
Yeah, it is a good name. Hinterland, which I like.
You watched it twice.
Yeah.
I haven't watched anything either. No one has time to watch anything in the summer.
Well, no. So many other things to do. And besides, I have to bone up on...
You've got a lot of podcasts to prepare for.
Bone up on the podcasts.
talking of podcasts, I mean, obviously, because we're in it. Please, can everybody please subscribe to us on iTunes and write us reviews, because that will help us get more listeners.
Please do.
And we're really trying to
get
some more listeners. We'd love more people. So if everyone who's listening could tell one friend.
Yes, one friend.
To listen.
Absolutely.
We would be
massively grateful.
Absolutely thrilled.
We would.
Anything we can do to...
And the other thing, of course, which we say from time to time, is any feedback, you know,
please
good or
us.
Bad, email us.
What Twitter, Instagram.
Instagram.
I've got some good pics of Geoffrey of old to put up on the Insta, so worth giving us a follow just for that. It's going to be a few of Dad in his 20s.
I'm glad I don't have Instagram or watch it or look at it. I don't have Twitter either, but we do have this podcast has all of that.
Yes.
And I think that's great for it and for us.
So what are we doing this week, Dad?
Well, I thought I'd do a contemporary, or very contemporary case of a man called Stephen Seddon. And I think it should be entitled The Ungrateful Son.
The Ungrateful Son. Here we go.
This is a heartbreaking story. Two eminently nice people, Bob Seddon and his wife Pat, were born just at the end of the war. Bob in 1944 and Pat in 1947. Bob, upright, they married in 1966. He was a ground maintenance engineer for British Airways at Manchester Airport, and she was a cleaner. They were absolutely upright, honourable, saved for a house, and they thought, well, we're married now, we're going to have children. And the first child was born in 1967, in August, the 31st of August 1967, was called Stephen. They christened him Stephen. Then, a year later, in 1968, they had a daughter called Leslie. Now, Leslie was very much the apple of her father Bob's eye. They live in outside Manchester, Cheshire, on the borders. Tragically, at the age of 7, Leslie contracts a disease that leads to her being diagnosed with epilepsy, and she needs a great deal of care. It's pure speculation on my part, but there is little doubt in my mind that the family skewed with Leslie's diagnosis towards her and away from Stephen. And it's not a coincidence, not in my mind at any rate, that by the time Stephen is a teenager, he gets into all sorts of trouble with the law.
Attention seeking, maybe.
Yeah, I would have said attention seeking. I agree. Absolutely. He fell into a crowd who were into low-level crime. They were stealing bikes, taking little things from houses. Bob and Pat found Stephen very difficult to control. And besides, they're focusing all their energies on their daughter, Leslie. Stephen's behaviour just led him into more and more trouble with the police. Bob didn't like it. Pat was close to him and would have forgiven him anything. And in 1987, Bob and Pat had the opportunity to move up the property ladder a little because Bob's mother had recently died. And so they decided to keep her house in the family and buy it. So they were very sane people, very down to earth, saved their money. And so they moved into the house with Leslie. But now, by this point, Stephen is 20 and has gone to live in a flat in Manchester, in the centre of Manchester. And they're now in Sale in Cheshire. So Bob, Pat and Leslie are in Bob's mother's former house. Nice, semi-detached, quite a comfortable house, you know, nice road, you know, a bit of garden front and back, and, you know. Stephen appears to turn his life round. All of a sudden, out of nowhere, he and a partner start a company, and it's called European Business Solutions. It's effectively, I'm sorry, European Business Support and Solutions. It doesn't appear on the surface, but what the idea is that Stephen rings up a small company, any small company, and says, I'm sure I can access all kinds of grants from Europe and Britain to help your development. All I ask for is £300 in advance and, you know.
Sounds dodgy to me.
Well, it becomes very successful. He has the charm of a car salesman. I mean, he really is very good on the phone and very good. And so before long, he's got a Bentley Turbo, a Porsche, a boat on Lake Windermere. And guess what? He's also got married. He meets a girl called Nicola in a Manchester lap dancing club. And
is she a lap dancer?
No, I don't think
she was just a punter.
I think she was just there. Mm. They decide that they are going to be together, and indeed, they begin to have 3 children. EBS is going pretty well. They decide to move to be near Nicola's parents, who live in the northeast of England, Seaham in Northumberland. And indeed, they have a daughter called Shannon and then 2 boys, Matthew and Stephen Jr. in 2002. But by this time, and let's just go back to Bob and Pat for a minute, by this time, Leslie has had a son, Daniel. Even though she handles the epilepsy remarkably well.
Mm-hmm.
And has a relationship, bears a child, who sadly has pretty severe learning difficulties. Stephen's business is apparently going from strength to strength. He has a chauffeur now.
Chauffeur? That's very grand.
I mean, we are talking about considerable splashing the cash. Mm. Unfortunately, Trading Standards begin an investigation of European business, etc., which discovers, of course, that no European grants have been accessed at all. All that's happening is that various companies have paid him £300 and he's pocketed all the cash.
It must be... I mean, you'd have to call hundreds of companies to...
No, they did. Hundreds.
Hundreds and hundreds.
Yes. Hundreds.
That's mad.
Well, people...
That's a scam.
It's a... So Trading Standards arrives at Stephen Seddon's door. In fact, it's the house that he and Nicola now own, or are living in Seaham. They don't own it at that point. And say they're going to try Seddon for fraud. And in March 2000, Seddon is sentenced to a year in jail for the fraud of European business. He gets out and tries to... how can one put it, get his life back together. But in fact, it's spiralling ever more quickly out of control. Nevertheless, he struggles. He goes from job to job, can't settle, turns to everyone for help. Bob and Pat, his parents, are, as ever, terribly kind. Kind people. And they basically, they lend him money. Constantly lending money. They help him get a mortgage for a house in Seaham. They, I think, help him towards the mortgage, help him give him £25,000 in cash, remortgage their house in Sale to give him money. Seddon isn't really interested. I mean, he can't do it, can't get... Everything is coming apart. He's now in his 40s. It's... the first months of 2012. One sad fact, however, before we get to 2012, is that in 2008, Leslie, his sister, and Bob and Pat's child, dies in her sleep. And the wills are redrawn. Bob and Pat make each other beneficiaries of their wills. Mm-hmm. But if either of them die, the money goes to Stephen Seddon. Stephen Seddon becomes obsessed with the fact that there's at least £250,000 in equity in their house. Bob's mother's house, which they now live in.
Yeah.
And that £250,000 would go nicely towards getting another Bentley. And
why would he want a Bentley now he's lost everything?
Well, I'm afraid it's a man who lives in a... There is a most extraordinary... And I do... is the most extraordinary video... of Stephen Seddon, and I'll come on to it in a minute.
Okay.
I'll come on to what it is. Stephen offers to become Daniel's guardian if anything happens to Bob and Pat. In reality, he simply wants more and more, can't hold down a job, longs for the high life again. And the only obstacle to him getting back on his feet is Bob and Pat's being alive.
He just thinks if he has £250,000, that it suddenly everything will be fine.
Yes.
People are so stupid.
Well, he is a remarkable man in many ways. Horrifying in others. I mean, these are two of the most extraordinarily honourable, upright people. By now we're talking about 2012. They've been looking after Daniel, their grandson, Leslie's son. They've been sending Stephen money hand over fist. Bob's now 68 and retired from his job at BA. With
They're
BA.
Not even old.
They're 65. Pat's 65 and he's 68. It's the first months of 2012. Stephen comes up with a really remarkable plan. He decides that he's going to take them out, Bob, Pat and Daniel, for a ride in a blue BMW that he's hired specially, and they're going to celebrate Mother's Day. It's just after Mother's Day, but never mind. It's the 20th of March, 2012. He arrives, driven down from the northeast to the house in Sale in Cheshire, puts Daniel in the front seat, seatbelt on, puts Bob and Pat in the back seat. Don't forget to fasten your seatbelts. Very important. He has not only taken out insurance for a car that doesn't need, because what if something happened to it? He's taken with him a sharp knife and one of those steering wheel locks. Doesn't need a steering wheel lock. It's got a lock of its own, but never mind. He's taken it with him. And it then becomes clear what he had in mind. It's mid-afternoon, quotes. They're going out for lunch. And he's driving along beside a canal. And all of a sudden, he feigns a heart attack and turns the car into the canal. Unbelievable, you might have said. Well, I don't know what was in his mind, but not surprisingly, two boys on the towpath immediately call the police. They've got mobile phones, in no time. He gets out of the car himself through the window by smashing it with the steering wheel lock. He's having cut his seatbelt.
Oh, God.
With a knife, leaving Daniel, Bob and Pat in the car. And what does he do? He sits on the roof of the car and, having noticed the two boys, pretends to try and kick the windows in with his feet. It's the most bizarre series of circumstances. He realises, of course, watching these two boys have seen everything, he then realises he's going to have to rescue Daniel. So he gets Daniel out of the front of the car with some difficulty because Daniel is absolutely terrified. He gets Bob out of the car just, again, absolutely terrified because the car is now underwater.
Mm.
And he can't get Pat. She's quite a big lady and he can't get... But by that point, the fire brigade has arrived. And miracle of miracles, they managed to get Pat out of the car. She goes into cardiac arrest. They do CPR and they bring her back to life.
God, how terrifying.
So all three survive.
They must find the cut in the in his slashing of the seatbelt.
Well, let's put it this way. Stephen presents himself to the world as a hero. Indeed, there's a video, if you look on YouTube, of Stephen Seddon giving evidence to the camera about his heroic behaviour in saving Daniel and Bob. And then, thank goodness, the fire brigade came and saved Pat. It's a piece of vanity that really is breathtaking. Absolutely breathtaking. But at this point, nobody knows it was an attempted murder. It just looks like he was heroic and they had... The only trouble is his story about a heart attack. Well, the ambulance arrives and he, just to convince them, he falls down, pretends to have another one.
Mm.
They take him to hospital where, of course, he's found to have no heart attack at all.
Mm.
However, all is well. Nobody's lost except the car and there's no case to answer. On the surface, thank goodness it all went so well.
Yeah.
But the trouble is that now he's really, really furious. This is in March 2012. On the 2nd of July 2012, he decides to take Nicola and two of his children to a caravan which, believe it or not, Bob and Pat have paid for, in a park in Fleetwood, north of Seaham. He parks them there and then remembers, quotes, that he has got to have an appointment at the job centre on the Wednesday, the 6th. The 6th of July, 2012. Sorry, the 4th of July, beg your pardon, the 4th of July, the Wednesday of that week. So he goes to the caravan, drives back to see him, makes his appointment at the job centre, and then puts into action, a plan which one can only describe as horrifying. He borrows a car and leaves his mobile phone with a friend so that it isn't tracked. It sticks in northeast England. Mm-hmm. He drives 2.5 hours across from Seaham to Sale. Bob and Pat have been having fish and chips together at the kitchen table. Bob usually goes out to get them. It's a Wednesday. Pat's upstairs hoovering, and Bob's sitting downstairs watching television. Seddon has procured from some of his rather less than savoury acquaintances a sawn-off shotgun with the number filed off, of course, so it can't be traced. Sawn-off shotgun. And parks near Bob and Pat's house and creeps round the back and enters the house through the kitchen door. He walks into the living room and without a moment's hesitation shoots Bob in the chest just above the throat, killing him instantly. He's only got 3 cartridges and he only uses the left-hand barrel, but it's very long and complicated to go into why that is. So he shoots. Of course, Pat hears the explosion and rushes downstairs.
Is he wearing like a mask or anything?
No. He kills her with the shotgun.
Oh my God, that's terrible.
Another shotgun blast. Kills her outright. And then goes back into the sitting room to try and make it look as though it's a murder-suicide, that Bob has killed Pat and then killed himself.
You can't shoot yourself in the chest with a sawn-off shotgun unless your arms are about 3 times the length of normal arms.
Well, as you would quite rightly say, He's not smart, this one. Yeah, the other thing that would have happened if it had been a murder-suicide is that the recoil would have been so dramatic, the gun would... Because Stephen puts the gun on his father Bob's lap. The recoil alone would have thrown it across the room. Mm. So, you know, anybody with half an ounce of forensic insight knows that that one isn't going to fly.
Surely you would try and make it look like an intruder and a burglary rather than a murder-suicide.
Well.
If you were going to make it look like something.
Okay, so guess what? Stephen gets back into the borrowed BMW, dumps the sawn-off shotgun, drives all the way back to the northeast, makes sure he's seen on the CCTV of his local supermarket, and then drives back to the caravan in Fleetwood. As much to say, oh, well, I was just in town for a bit and I bought some beer back.
Now I'm back.
Yeah, so here I am back. And so he's back in the caravan, and as far as he knows, his parents are perfectly all right. The reality is, of course, that he's killed them. However, at the outset, the police are tempted by the murder-suicide theory, and they get a pathologist to attend the scene. The forensic pathologist they get says that Seddon Bob died after suffering a severe injury to the base of the neck, with the shot fired downwards at him. Death would have been very rapid and there was no evidence he had tried to fend off his killer. The pathologist told in evidence that Mrs. Seddon, who was found lying in the hallway, suffered a gaping gunshot injury after being shot in the back of the head, and that she had tried to fight off her attacker.
But that would mean that she saw him and then she turned around and he shot her in the back of the head. Yes. That is just so awful.
Yes, I'm afraid it is true. It is a particularly horrifying attack, this.
This man's vile.
Yeah. But of course, now the attention is turned to none other than Stephen Seddon, the man who has heroically saved Bob and Pat from the car only 4 months earlier.
Slash tried to drown Bob and Pat.
Yes. 4 months earlier. And most significantly of all, on the day before the attack, on the 4th of July, Bob had gone to his GP and he told the GP that he was certain that that crash was attempted murder.
Really?
He told his GP, who was a bit rather astounded, that he was going to have it out with his son. That was actually an attempt to kill them. Because, and he said it, because he wants the money. He wants the house. And he'll do anything to get it. That, together with the evidence of it, a murder-suicide being impossible, a long police investigation, they managed to trace the car that's come from the northeast, goes back to the northeast. He had an alibi, but not between 11 and half past four, and that's more than enough time to drive there and kill them and come back again. Mm. It was a long and complex investigation, but once they'd added the GP, the car, and the evidence of the first crash, of the crash into the canal, he becomes a prime suspect, a person of interest in the most major way. And on the 12th of July, just 8 days after he's effectively killed his parents, he had actually bought a third cartridge, thinking that Daniel was going to be there, because he was going to kill him as well, just in case there'd be no blurring about who might get the will.
Yeah.
Okay. Daniel, in fact, has been taken out by respite care at that particular day, and indeed it was the respite carer who's bringing Daniel back to Bob and Pat's house on the 6th of July.
Who found them. Poor person.
Well, it was dreadful. At this point, Stephen Seddon's using a nickname, another name he uses, which is Nick Seddon. The police managed to triangulate his mobile phone and discover that he, but not it, hadn't left the northeast. It's, in the end, it's a very ugly murder. He stands trial in February 2013 at Manchester Crown Court and pleads not guilty. His excuse for being in Manchester, because he's now admitted that he was in Manchester on the 4th of July, it was on a drug run near his parents' house.
What nonsense.
Yes. Well, he has had some brushes with drugs. The police admitted in evidence that it was a difficult case, as they had to convince a jury that a son could murder their parents with the sole motive being money.
Money. Like last week.
Rather, yes.
Motive
was money. And at one point, Seddon shouts from the dock, "No, not at all. They weren't murdered by me at all. I'm an innocent man." And the judge tells him to keep quiet.
And say he's a liar.
Yes. Mr. Justice Hamblin continues with his sentencing remarks. 35 days after the trial has begun, and after 18 hours of deliberation, the jury found Stephen guilty of the murder of both his parents and the attempted murder of both his parents.
For the previous.
The crash and the shotgun. It is absolutely astonishing. And in his remarks, Mr. Justice Hamblin says, "You have been convicted of heinous crimes, first attempting to murder your parents and then, less than 4 months later, actually murdering them. A continuum of crime culminated in the cold-blooded killing of a quiet, unassuming elderly couple in their own home." One might add, an elderly couple who had been nothing but generous to Seddon. He continued to say, which I think was very telling, "In Greek mythology, someone who killed a parent would be pursued until death by the Furies. Throughout time, it has been recognised as a terrible and unnatural crime. You've killed not one parent, but both. One can only imagine the horror of your parents' last moments in this life when they realised what a monster their own son, who they loved, had become." Stephen Seddon is given a life sentence with a minimum of 40 years. You could argue that he deserved a whole life term. Yeah. I personally would, but we've had conversations about whole life terms before, but I think this is a particularly unpleasant crime.
Horrible.
A minimum of 40 years will mean he'll be in his mid-80s before he'll even be considered for parole, and I suspect by that time he'll be so institutionalised it'll be impossible.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, as he left the dock, he persisted he was innocent.
Why?
But I do think it's a particularly interesting and really quite horrifying case, because they couldn't have been a more loving parents.
He doesn't have any compassion.
No.
Feeling for them at all.
And imagine,
or I presume for anyone.
No, except himself.
Just so desperate to not, like, let it all go.
Yes.
Even though what he did to make money in the first place
was a crime.
Yeah.
Mm. Yes. I have no sympathy for Stephen Seddon whatever.
No.
But if the case proves anything, it's that money is a powerful motive.
Yeah.
And it's not just sex that motivates murderers, it's money as well. Anyway, sorry, that's a bit of a sad case, because I really felt for Bob and Pat, and they're just such a sweet, upright people.
Well, that's really sad.
Yeah.
I don't know what should have that happen to them.
Nope.
Well, thank you very much.
That was The Ungrateful Son. What's happening next week?
Don't know. Hopefully nothing. Hopefully we can all just have a rest now, because it's July. It's nearly your birthday.
Yes, it's my birthday soon. Oh, dear.
Oh, dear.
Oh, dear.
Uh-oh.
Oh, dear.
The time presses on.
Yes, relentlessly.
Never ends.
It doesn't, no. The Grim Reaper doesn't stop weeping.
I just booked another holiday to Bologna.
Well done, you.
I went to Bologna last year, do you remember?
I do.
It was very nice, so me and my girlfriend, who I went with, are going back again.
Good food?
Just for the weekend. Yeah, we're going for the food.
Food, it's always such a good place to go.
It's the food capital of Italy, Geoffrey.
Yes, I think you told me that last
time. Yeah, I probably did tell you and everyone listening about what we call the round sandwiches. You go to this like place we called Charcuterie Alley, and they have these, they bring you these little breads, like round, thin breads that are cut in half, and then they bring you a plate of meat and cheese, and you like...
You make your own.
Yeah, and it's delicious, and I'm very excited about having round sandwiches.
That's very good.
I booked to go to LA for work.
Oh, wonderful. When are you going to LA?
November.
Ah, good time to go.
Yeah.
Very good time to go to LA. Very.
Before my birthday.
Yeah.
So, yeah, lots going on.
Well, I think that's all very positive. And we should thank a couple of people again, shouldn't we?
We should thank all of our people. Poppy Damon, our producer, who's the best. Barney Spiegel, who helped us solve our sound issue, for whom we are eternally grateful. My brother Dan, who made the music. My friend George, who drew our caricature. And my colleague and friend Hannah, who helps us with all things podcast. And Audio Boom, who are hosting us and being very helpful and kind.
That's very. We are very, very grateful. But most of all, we have to thank you, the listeners, for listening. And do please tell a friend about us, because we want to get our listeners up for everyone. And it's always a pleasure. It's great to have the opportunity to share sometimes quite miserable cases, but they are interesting. It's genuinely interesting.
Yeah, thanks, Dad.
And one final thing is, as I say now at the end of every podcast, do be careful out there.